Thank you. Craig Kane with the law firm of Kane and White. Registration number 15930. We're here because of a ditch. Little background, July 25th, 2006, my client Rice and Rice entered into an agreement with Larson North Development Corporation, the developer, to perform construction work to assist in realigning an irrigation ditch to include installation of the ditch's clay liner as well as seeding and hydro mulching. The purpose was to realign the ditch, which was owned by the Fountain Mutual Irrigation Company, known as FMIC. September 28, 2006, the district, which is the plaintiff in our case and the defendant in the first case, assumed the obligation of the developer under the August 17, 2006 agreement between the developer and FMIC. June 15, 2009, FIMC sued the districts for breach, but not Rice and Rice, alleging problems with the ditch. Rice and Rice did testify at that first lawsuit, and that was pretty much the extent of their participation in that first lawsuit. November 24th, 2010, a bench trial was held, and the court in that case found in favor of FMIC against the districts, essentially finding there were problems with the ditches. January 27, 2011, the developer signed to the districts the agreement with my client, Rice and Rice. February 18, 2011, the districts sue Rice and Rice, and also the other subcontractors involved in the realignment of the ditch to include Frazee Construction, Mallon Developmental Company, and Kumar and Associates. Excuse me. The claims against Rice and Rice were: one, breach of contract, essentially didn't construct the ditch as they were supposed to; two, negligence in their performance; and three, non-contractual indemnity of the judgment for FMIC entered against the district by FMIC. August 28, 2011, the district's plaintiff in this second case filed a motion for partial summary judgment seeking application of the doctrine of issue preclusion as to the claims and defenses between the districts and Rice and Rice. And this, I contend, is probably the most important issue in this case. Essentially, the court was saying that the court's findings in the prior bench trial action, in which Rice and Rice was not a party and did not participate to any extent, are binding on Rice and Rice and the other ditch contractors in the second case. Rice and Rice objected to the issue preclusion. Among the basis, Rice and Rice was not a party to that first bench trial. Rice and Rice was never in privity with the defendant in that case.
Counsel, didn't Rice and Rice and the district have a joint interest in defeating the claims of FMIC?
To a certain extent, the general claims, yes. Basically, to say, was did the ditch perform how it was supposed to? The problem is that the defendant in that case, a little bit differently situated. They were defending generally that, okay, we gave you a good ditch. They were not focusing on both the design defects and also the construction defects. Very important point, because from my client's perspective, construction defects, to the extent they were responsible, yes, we could get hit with that. Design defects, that's a different person, and we in fact wanted to use that as a defense in this second trial. So the defendant in the first case really did not have the incentive to distinguish between design and construction defects. And we believe that is very important.
Thank you.
Okay. Certainly in the second, Rice and Rice had requested a jury trial, and four of the cause of action in the prior bench trial were different from those in the subsequent suit. Again, in the first suit, we had express warranty claims between the two parties. In our suit, there were claims for breach of contract, of course, two, negligence, and three, common law indemnity. The court granted the motion, found against Rice and Rice. Rice and Rice supplemented this with a motion for reconsideration, adding two more bases to defeat issue preclusion in this case. One, that the court's order essentially was contrary to and really undermined SIDARA, the Construction Defect Action Reform Act. I always have to read that off. And six, that Rice and Rice did not have a full and fair opportunity to litigate the claim in the prior FMIC action. Motion for reconsideration, again denied. On July 29, 2011, Rice and Rice designated non-parties at fault, designated the engineers of the ditch alignment for the design issues, as well as the other defendants that were sued in the second litigation in case they were to be dismissed. April 29, 2013, Rice and Rice specifically requested that the ditch contractors Frazee and Kumar, who had settled out at that time, be listed on the verdict form along with the ditch engineer so that the jury could consider their potential comparative faults. The court denied that. May 9th, 2013, there were hearings. I was involved in these. My former partner, Christine Hader, was. She's subsequently moved to Georgia due to family reasons, but I've talked to her occasionally when things were coming up, and this case did seem to get curiouser and curiouser as I spoke to her while it was going on. May 19, 2013, the court entered orders one, striking Rice and Rice's designation of non-parties, two, excluding any evidence of fault of anyone other than Rice and Rice, three, refusing to allow any opportunity, any apportionment of damages to anyone other than Rice and Rice, four, determining that Rice and Rice was jointly and severally responsible for the other subcontractors and the design and or construction work on the ditch, and five, confirming exclusion of any evidence regarding faulty design issues as causation for the district's claimed ditch-related damages, including excluding the testimony of Rice and Rice's expert that they had had retained and timely and properly endorsed to testify that it was the design issues of this ditch and not construction problems by Rice and Rice that were the cause of the problems with the ditch. Case went to trial. The verdict was for the districts and against Rice and Rice. Verdict form, $250,000 for common law indemnity, also $150,000 for contractual indemnity, which the court threw out and only went with the $250,000. Post-trial motions that are important. The court denied Rice and Rice a set-off for the funds the district received from settling with these other co-defendants for the same claims that were being charged against Rice and Rice. It's interesting because the total amount was $280,000, which would have actually exceeded the amount of the verdict, even though there were fees and costs involved in the verdict. So there are a lot of issues in this case. The briefs are long. I think there are 12 total issues between the two of us. And I submit to you that all of them essentially are due to the train running off the track in this case when the court initially said issue preclusion applies to this case. Essentially, on behalf of Rice and Rice, we're contending that because of the ruling on the issue preclusion, we did not get a fair chance to defend against the claims, potentially apportion against other defendants, and raise the issue of design defects over and above any construction defect claims. The circumstances of Rice and Rice in that first lawsuit, one, they were subcontractor on the ditch repairs. Two, no claim was made against them. They were not a party to that case. No one, there's no evidence that anyone ever said, hey, if this doesn't work out, we're going to come after you for indemnity.
Couldn't Rice and Rice anticipate that, though?
I think perhaps most of the folks in this room could potentially anticipate that. But you've got a situation here. I think it's a situation where you're looking at issue preclusion. You have to take a look at the facts of the particular case. We have a situation where they're called in to provide some testimony apparently did not make a claim, their insurance company didn't bring an attorney involved, didn't know they had to do that. These are construction folks trying to make a buck. Could they technically? Again, if they had our kind of knowledge, that's a possibility. They did not. And of course, and also there's no evidence that Rice and Rice, which is important to the issue preclusion, actually participated in the defense of the express warranty claims in that first trial. They were simply subpoenaed to testify. That was the extent on the record of their involvement. Of course, for issue preclusion to occur, one, the issues must be identical in the prior proceeding, contend they were not. Two, Rice and Rice needs to be in privity with defendant at the prior proceeding. Three, final judgment. Four, Rice and Rice had a full and fair opportunity to litigate the issues. If you take a look at the authority with regard to what constitutes privity, again, which I believe is central to this case, the quote's in the brief, page 14, privity means that a non-party is related to the case in such a way that he or she should be regarded as a party. That's the Strettle v. Espy case. Privity between a party and a non-party requires both. One, a substantial identity of interests, and two, a working or functional relationship in which the interests of the non-party are presented and protected by the party in the litigation. It's the SOV case. One more, preclusion is fair so long as the relationship between the non-party and a party was such that the non-party had the same practical opportunity to control the course of the proceedings that would be available to a party. That's the restatement second of judgments. Defendant consents is clear, there was no privity here. If you take a look at the court's order finding privity, these are the five things that the court looked at with regard to finding a privity relationship between a defendant in the prior case and my client Rice and Rice. One, that Rice and Rice was in a position in the first action brought by FMC and was that of a friendly non-party. Two, that Rice and Rice was aware of the suit. Three, that the districts in the first suit had the same interest as Rice and Rice in vigorously defending the suit. Four, that Rice and Rice employees did testify. Five, that Rice and Rice could have intervened at any time. With regard to the friendly non-party, this is the first time I have seen that in Colorado law or anywhere else as a basis for privity. It was not argued in the briefs. Apparently the court just came up with it. Friendly non-party, what does that mean? In response to legal subpoenas that they had to respond to, did they bring donuts? I don't know. Certainly that would be friendly, but it has nothing to do with either privity or does it support issue preclusion. Second, aware of the suit. Certainly that does not equate to privity. Third, defending the first suit, neither are, as mentioned before in response to the question, they did not have the incentive to argue the distinction between design defects or construction defects. The former takes our client out of the equation. The latter, yeah, that's an issue we would have to deal with. Fourth, it is true that Rice and Rice employees were subpoenaed to testify, but no evidence of them working, of a working or functional relationship between Rice and Rice and defendant districts in the first lawsuit. There's no evidence the defendants solicited any input from them. They were simply subpoenaed and showed up. But if you take a look at our brief, pages 5 and 6 of the answer brief, Colorado and many other states support simply because you're subpoenaed and testify in a case does not mean that that does not create privity. And we could, fifth, with regard, there's no authority for the trial court's position that a party's potential ability to intervene in a matter equates to privity with one of the actual litigants. Consequently, we feel that privity, which is, we believe, the most important issue with regard to this issue preclusion, which, again, the train goes off the tracks and all these other issues we contend are essentially related to that problem of the issue preclusion. Because of that, the court does not allow our witnesses, does not allow testimony with regard to potential fault of other parties, and all kind of goes downhill from there. At this point, I'd ask to save the last 30 seconds or so for any rebuttal. Thank you very much.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Eric Hall, bar number 32028. I'm here on behalf of the Lorson Ranch Metropolitan Districts, Appalee. With me on the briefs is Amy Wills. This construction defect litigation followed a very familiar pattern. First, we had the construction defect lawsuit here that was FMIC suing Lorson for failing to deliver the realigned ditch as promised. After a four-day bench trial, which was October 26th to 29th of 2010, the trial court sided with FMIC and against Lorson. It entered a final judgment against Lorson on February 15th, 2011, in the amount of $480,000. 3 days later, Lorson sued Rice and the other subcontractors for indemnity. That was on February 18th, 2011. This is precisely the two-stage process contemplated under SIDARA, namely the construction defect lawsuit first and then the indemnity lawsuit second. Furthermore, it was proper and not at all surprising that the court precluded Rice from relitigating the same issues that were decided in the FMIC litigation. Rice actively participated in the FMIC construction defect litigation, and contrary to what opposing counsel just represented to you, its interests were aligned with Lorson's.
Counsel?
Yes, sir.
I want to challenge you on that conclusory statement. What did they do other than show up pursuant to subpoena to testify?
The president of Rice and Rice, Ty Rice, was deposed.
Yes, pursuant to a subpoena, which he had, of course, no ability to reject or he had to comply with.
All of the interests of...
Let's focus on my question, which was, how did they actively participate in the litigation other than testifying as subpoenaed witnesses? What is in the record?
In the record, again, the president was deposed, employees testified. Your Honor, those are the only two things I can think of in the record. I look to the October 4th, 2012 order by the trial court that, again, opposing counsel just referred to, and as the trial court related there, and again, this is the same trial court that presided over the FMIC litigation and ruled on the issue preclusion issue. The trial court there said that Lorson and Rice's interests were aligned, that Lorson had every incentive and Rice had every incentive to litigate all the issues, all the defect issues fully, and that Lorson provided, quote, a vigorous defense, vigorously defended all the issues, the design defect issues as well as the construction defect issues.
What support in the record is there for that assertion beyond the fact that they testified as witnesses?
Your Honor, again, not only would I point you to this order that is referred to, page 981 in the record, but I also point you to the trial court's decision, which was November 24th, 2010, which is pages 119 through 131 of the record, and specifically I point you to pages 124 to 126 of that decision, which is where the trial court, again, the same judge, laid out all the testimony, all the evidence that occurred in the first trial, including the fact that all the subcontractors, all their interests aligned, and that Lorson defended them vigorously on behalf of all the subcontractors.
Did Lorson defend Rice and Rice on the basis that it wasn't construction defects that caused the problems, it was design defects?
Your Honor, all the testimony about both design defects and construction defects was presented in the FMIC litigation. Again, if you look at page 126.
That wasn't my question. My question was, did Lorson defend the case on the basis that design defects caused the problems with the ditch, not construction defects?
Yes, Your Honor, because Lorson hired Pentacor. Pentacor was the engineer. Lorson would have been on the hook for any of Pentacor's design defect issues.
So Lorson had no incentive at all to argue that Pentacor had acted negligently in design.
It absolutely did, Your Honor. To the contrary, because it hired Pentacor, and Lorson was the general developer, it would have been on the hook for any defects that Pentacor had, and it defended not only Pentacor but Rice and all the other subcontractors.
My point is, though, that it defended Pentacor. Rice and Rice wants to point the finger at Pentacor, okay, and said, no, Pentacor is responsible. Okay, but Lorson and Lorson didn't say, no, the construction guys aren't responsible, Pennacor is responsible, because if Pennacor was responsible, then your client was responsible.
Your Honor, Lorson vigorously defended the construction, all the construction defect cases. Again, contrary to what opposing counsel just said, it's not the case. In the FMIC litigation, Lorson did not present a robust defense as to any and all defects. Lorson, in fact, did. It said there were no defects. It argued that. It lost on that issue. The court did find defects, but the court also noted, again on page 126, that there was no evidence that design defects were present, and therefore it went on to conclude there was erosion, the ditch was damaged, FMIC did not get the ditch it was promised, therefore there were construction defects, and then proceeded to list all the construction defects. With the reason the Rice was precluded from arguing the same issues again is because in the first case, the court exhaustively heard and litigated and decided what caused the damage to the ditch. The court heard and decided it was not design defects, and rather determined it was construction defects, and then listed those construction defects. Some of those construction defects had to do with other subcontractors' work, and some of them had to do with the clay compaction and the seeding and the hydromulching. That was what Rice was hired for. So again, in the FMIC litigation, Lorson had the incentive to and did defend against all the defects. Lorson argued in the FMIC litigation that, again, there were no defects, and the cause of the erosion was the freeze and thaw cycle, something not related to any of the workers, any of the subcontractors' work. Again, the first court found that was not the case. The first court found there were construction defects and then listed those defects. Those issues were properly precluded under the issue preclusion decision. Again, same judge decided both, and that decision, like opposing counsel correctly pointed out, was challenged after it was made numerous times. It was brought to this court under an interlocutory appeal. It was revisited half a dozen times with the trial court, and every time the trial court found no, the issues about what caused the damage to the ditch, design and construction, were fully and fairly litigated in the FMIC case, and so they should not be relitigated again. This case is extremely similar to the Osmos Wood case that this court decided in 1991. In that case, we had two parties, the utility company and the injured party. The injured party was a worker who was on a utility pole. The pole snapped while he was working on the pole, and then the first trial assessed what caused the damage. What caused the pole to snap? Who was responsible for that pole snapping and the person being injured? In that case, 85% of the damage was assigned to the utility company, 15% to the employee. But then the utility company then sought to bring in Osmos Wood, who the company had hired to review and make sure all the utility poles were correctly maintained. In that second trial, the trial judge did not even entertain issue preclusion, went on and had a second trial, and the second trial found that the worker was 100% responsible. So then we had inconsistent judgments in that case. When that case came to this court remanded and said it was improper for the trial court to go ahead with that second trial when Osmos Wood had similar interests as the utility company, and the utility company litigated those interests. And the issue of what caused the pole to snap was fully and fairly litigated. It was sent back down for reconsideration. Again, we would submit that Osmos Wood and this case are very similar, and we believe the record in the trial court's orders bear that out.
Talking about the trial court's order, counsel, what law supports the trial court's conclusion that privity existed based in part on the fact, according to the court, that Rice could have intervened in the litigation? I mean, why should a non-party be forced to jump into a lawsuit when the plaintiff in that original case isn't asserting claims at that point against that non-party?
Again, issue preclusion, Your Honor, is designed to prevent inconsistent judgments. It's designed to maintain judicial economy, and when there are, again, identical issues, privity, full and fair opportunity to litigate the issues, as were the case in this case, preclusion is properly applied. So Osmos Wood is one, Your Honor. Goldsworthy is another, also dealt with privity in a case where the parties against which privity was found had not participated in the, in that case, first and second bits of litigation. It was class action litigation against an insurance company. In the first two class action litigations, the class was not certified for various issues. A third class action was brought, that's the Goldsmithy case, and in that case, preclusion was properly held to apply. The Bristol Bay case, 2013 case from the Colorado Supreme Court, there the court considered identity of issues and found that, again, there can be identity of issues even when the parties did not participate in the first litigation. We cite other cases in our brief, Your Honor, but again, there are, those are at least three decisions where parties can be found to be in privity and issue preclusion properly held against them even though they didn't participate in the first trial.
Counsel, you're conflating the issues of identity of issues and privity. Those are separate elements of the test. And the trial court, frankly, did the same thing. I mean, it said, well, they had this incentive and they were the same issues. And, well, that's not a privity analysis. The privity analysis focuses on the functional relationship in the prior litigation between the party who was in the litigation and the party that was not. I haven't seen a single case that says just being a witness is enough to establish privity. And that's all there was here in the record. You've just said it.
Your Honor, again, I'd submit to you the Osmos Wood case. I think Osmos Wood was similarly situated to Rice here.
Well, in Osmos Wood, the court said that there is evidence that Osmos actively participated in PSC's defense in the Rose litigation.
Yes,
that's different than here. All we have here is a party that's subpoenaed. That's it. That's not active participation in a defense of a case. What were they supposed to do to avoid privity? Defy the subpoena to protect their rights? I mean, they had no choice.
Well,
that is not a functional relationship between the two of you. That is not cooperation between the two of you. It is not participation in presenting the defense. It's just showing up pursuant to a subpoena. They cited a whole bunch of cases from a whole bunch of places saying that's not enough. I didn't see any rebuttal to that in your reply.
Well, again, Your Honor, all I can provide to you are what is in the record, and what's in the record are the two court orders, which I think are key, which I've already cited to you and giving you the page numbers on, and the fact that Rice did participate both in the trial and in deposition hearings, and the fact that the judge was very well aware of who participated and how they participated because he presided over both cases.
But the judge who did that didn't cite anything in terms of participation other than showing up as a witness. He cited the evidence provided pursuant to subpoena, but that was it. That's all the judge cited.
Your Honor, I can only provide to you what's in the record, and I can also submit to you that, yes, privity is a functional test based upon the factors that you relate and other factors, including the ones that the court related, for instance, whether there was an identity of interests and whether the party below, in this case Lorson, defended those interests, and the court specifically said that Lorson vigorously defended those interests.
How did Lorson defend Rice's interest in pointing the finger at Pentacor?
Because Lorson argued that there were no defects.
That's not the same thing. Lorson argued Pentacor did nothing wrong. Rice has an incentive to argue that Pentacor indeed did something wrong. When did Lorson argue that Pentacor did something wrong?
Lorson did not argue that because Lorson was trying to defend itself and all the subcontractors, including Pentacor and Rice.
But its interest is only partially aligned because certainly Rice has that interest, but Rice has an alternative argument. None of us did anything wrong, but if somebody did something wrong, it was the designer.
And
you didn't make the second argument in the first case.
And Your Honor, that's one of the reasons why the trial court was proper to say if Rice had every opportunity to intervene if it wanted to. If it thought it needed to intervene, it could have.
Give me a cite for a case that says a non-party has to intervene in a case in which it is not sued to protect its rights to be free from this issue preclusion.
Your Honor,
I haven't seen one.
Your Honor,
that's kind of, think about it. You're saying a party has to incur litigation costs even when it's not sued to protect its rights?
Your Honor, I don't have a case site for that, but I do have the fact that under issue preclusion doctrine, it says, was there a full and fair opportunity? Part of the fairness analysis I would submit is, did they have an opportunity to intervene? And they did. So I thought that it was appropriate for the trial court to make that one of many factors as to why it believed issue preclusion was appropriate. In my remaining time, Your Honor, I'll just mention that if this court remands for a new trial, then our cross-appeal issues become live, become effective, and we would submit that if this court remands, then both the issue of the jury instructions on an indemnity case, the jury should have been instructed as to the amount we had to pay, and any sort of curative instructions to prevent Rice and Rice from trying to show apportionment when apportionment is clearly not allowed under 111.5 because only contract claims were at issue.
Mr. Hall, I see that your time is up.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Briefly, Your Honor.
Certainly, I think the questions are kind of hitting the nail on the head with regard to that they had really no incentive to pursue the design versus the construction aspects of the defects in the Osmos case. I don't think that they were brought in the manufacturer of the pole, which, of course, we did in this case with regard to the designer of the particular ditch. As to one of the questions, that's the Sadara, says this is a typical Sadara case. Typical Sadara case. You have the case up front, you decide who's at fault, you bring in the subs. This analysis would try to bring the subs in to this original case, contrary to Sadara. Thank you very much, if no questions.
All right, thank you, counsel, for your arguments. The case will stand submitted and a written opinion will issue in due course.